This is episode 2 of Coronavirus Lockdown. Today we ask, can Britain's NHS win the battle against COVID-19?
The coronavirus is the biggest threat this country has faced for decades.
We're at war. In a true sense, we're at war.
There's an ancient Chinese expression that says, may you live in interesting times.
Welcome to Coronavirus Lockdown with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. Today we're joined by NHS Dr. Sonia Adesara. When she's not at work, she's a super active campaigner for reproductive and migrant rights. Sonia will be giving us the lowdown on how the NHS is coping with this terrible crisis. Also joining us in the digital, not real world studio is Nick Dearden, Director of Global Justice Now, and a familiar voice to listeners of the Another Europe podcast. To feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future, please email podcast@anothereurope.org.
Every healthcare hero and care worker in the world is preparing for the tsunami that is coming.
Welcome both to the show. So, Sonia, what's been your experience of the NHS and COVID-19 so far? I know you've been self-isolating. Are you back at work?
No, so I'm back at work tomorrow. I've been self-isolating for 7 days. So I got sent home last week because I started to get a fever on the ward. So I think there's different ways I can answer that question. I think what I've seen in the past couple of weeks from some of my NHS colleagues has been phenomenal. And there's been some real individuals going out and beyond to create capacity in the NHS, to create new rotas, to move us from community into hospitals. So it's been unbelievable amount of work been going on behind the scenes to get the NHS ready for the influx of cases that we are seeing. But we have had a really difficult winter in the NHS. And on every parameter, whether it's, you know, waiting times in A&Es, if you're looking at waiting lists for operations, the number of A&Es going on black alert, we've had one of the most difficult winters on record. And I also think this crisis has really exposed problems in the NHS. So, of course, staff shortages is a real problem. Not having enough hospital beds, particularly ICU beds and critical care beds. And also, I think this crisis has really exposed the issue that we have in our NHS because of the internal market, and we have legislation that with the purchase provider split, we don't really have this nationalised coordinated healthcare service, which people think. Actually, we have a really fragmented healthcare service with hospital trusts and communities used to working in isolation. And actually, in an outbreak like this, what we really need is coordinated action. And I think we've been really struggling over the past couple of weeks with that.
Can I just drill in a little bit? You've been self-isolating because you had a fever. Do you think that it would have been much better if you'd been able to get a test? Or is that an obvious question?
Yes, of course. And I did actually, you know, for the past few weeks, I feel like I've been banging on about this, but it is ridiculous that there are many of us who are having to self-isolate because we have symptoms that could be coronavirus, or because we've had contact with someone with coronavirus. And this is really causing massive issues in the workforce. In one of the community teams that I was working in at a time when there used to be 4 doctors, at one point we went down to 1 doctor. We already have, you know, huge workforce shortages across the NHS, particularly in clinical teams. It just seems madness to me that we're not priority testing NHS workers to get people back in the workplace. And also, it's really important to know, like, I've had symptoms which could be coronavirus, it could be something else, but it'd be really useful for me to know that whether or not I've had it, so whether or not I've got immunity to the virus in the future as well.
Are there any signs of that situation improving? Because there seem to be a series of, I don't know, false hope in the news. The government is saying we've sorted it, we're prioritising frontline workers, but it doesn't seem to be happening.
Yeah, like a lot of these things, we're hearing the right words from the government, but actually when it comes to action on the ground, there's a bit of a delay in the right things happening. I've heard this week some of my colleagues says that they've been given testing, but the majority of people haven't been given testing. The problem is here now. So we've already got a situation where we've got, you know, some really severe staff shortages in teams right now in many of our hospitals. So bringing in testing next week or in 2 weeks' time is just no good. It needs to have been sorted now. And again, this is something that they've been calling for weeks. So this sort of the delay in getting this sorted is really unacceptable.
What about personal protective equipment?
Can you guarantee they won't get ill or indeed die because of a lack of personal protection equipment?
I will ensure that I do everything in my power to get people the equipment that they need.
Is that situation sorting itself out? What do you hear from colleagues?
Again, there's a mixed picture. I know in my trust that the person that we've been told that they have enough equipment and they will be delivering more equipment to the trust that we're working in. But I think, you know, the problem is wider than just having the equipment. I think there's been some real miscommunication about when you're supposed to be using the equipment and what equipment to use where. So there's been a lot of confusion among staff, and also different trusts and different departments are giving different advice to when to use it and when not to use it. And I also think there's a lot of, you know, we focus a lot on hospitals, but we always forget that there's people in the community as well who need that equipment. So I'm hearing a lot from my colleagues working in general practice, and also, you know, people working in social care, they also do need to be protected because, again, they're working on it, you know, regularly with elderly and vulnerable people and having lots of contact. So they also should be given equipment to stop themselves not just getting the infection, but also passing it on. We've been told the equipment is coming. It does seem to be coming, but there has been, you know, real communication issues about when and how to use it. And also, I think we keep forgetting about those in the community as well.
The other thing I was thinking, looking at those pictures of XL, is how, not just how daunting, but also how terrifying it must look like from inside the health service. Is that what people are saying, or is everybody just trying not to go there?
You know, I personally have been really impressed that they've managed to build this capacity in such short time. If you actually have a determination to do something, things can happen quickly. I think there is concern about where they're going to find the staff, because it looks huge from the pictures that I've seen, but you do need to have the right staff. It's not just about having, you know, doctors and nurses and the other frontline professionals, but also you need staff that are critically care trained, and that's something that we have a shortage of. There is a massive relief that we are building intensive care capacity, because there's been a real fear, particularly of those of us working in London, that we will very soon run out of intensive care beds. So there is a real relief that we are building intensive care capacity. I guess there is a frustration that this wasn't done a few weeks ago, because of course it takes time to build capacity, it takes time to train staff up and to upskill people. There is a frustration there, but no, but I think there is a relief that capacity has been built up as well.
Yeah, it's odd looking at it as an observer and the kind of contradictions between the awfulness and the positive. I mean, as you say, the XL Centre, I mean, that's an incredible achievement in construction terms to turn that around in a week. You mentioned the NHS England being sort of already semi-privatised just under a decade ago under the Lansley reforms with the clinical commissioning groups. In this crisis, the CCGs are completely taken over. So the NHS is renationalised and private healthcare is taken over. And it kind of implies that state-run services are the best to deliver patient care in an emergency situation. So then why not in an everyday situation?
Of course. And actually, it's exposed what we already know to be true, that having a state-run nationalised healthcare system is much more efficient and is able to provide better care for patients than having a fragmented privatised system. So, you know, I would hope going forward that actually this is, we're going in the right direction with regards to renationalising our healthcare services. I think though, with, you know, bringing back some private services back in-house, I know the government again said the right noises on this, but I'm not sure actually what has happened in practice so far. I just spoken to a few colleagues and no one seems to really know what's going on. As I understand it, this is a temporary thing, and after this crisis we will see a reversal going backwards. So I think, I guess that's something, as campaigners, something that we need to really make sure that we don't lead to reversal and we can continue to go in the right direction of renationalising our healthcare service, because it is more efficient and we get better care for everyone.
Nick, let's bring you in here, because you've obviously campaigned around privatisation and corporate takeover of health systems, not only in this country, but globally. How do you feel about, I don't know, the way in which the state and market relationship will look after this crisis? Are there reasons for hope?
I think there are reasons for hope. I mean, look, we've known since, the late 19th century that effectively markets produce very, very unequal outcomes. And we can see that in terms of the very unequal world that we live in now, where we've been told markets are the only solution, and it's created the most unbelievable, unprecedented inequality in history, as well as fueling climate change and all the rest of it. So we know that anyway. We also know, and have known for a very long time, that in a crisis situation, markets don't work at all. They entirely collapse, which is why, you know, even politicians completely committed to free market mechanisms have just said, we just have to step in and allow the state, the government, the public sector to plan and to provide this in a different way.
What I found really interesting is that so much probably can't go back to the way it was after this. You know, there's been so much money is no object. There's been so much whatever it takes. There's been so much kind of expressed care for the NHS, for NHS staff, that I can't see it going back to the austerity years.
What we're seeing now, I think, is proof of what we've known for a long time. And, you know, I think it's the job of us as campaigners to say exactly as you said in the question, if you can do this in an acute emergency because you know that ultimately it works, why can't you do it to sort out the chronic problems that we face in the world? Climate change, inequality, the fact that, you know, half the world's population doesn't have access to decent healthcare. All of this stuff could be solved if you weren't so utterly committed to the market being the only source of solutions to political problems in society.
How would you describe the state of the NHS going into the crisis? I mean, what's it like to work in an NHS hospital in 2019? And I don't know, how are you seeing that changing in 2020?
Yeah, so we have had 10 years of austerity and underfunding to public services. And year on year, it has been getting more difficult working in the NHS. We've seen over the past few years, funding cuts, beds being cut, severe staff shortages. So we have 100,000 vacancies across the NHS of clinical staff. And it has been difficult. So I was working in an A&E this winter. And, you know, quite frequently, we'd have 6-hour waits to see a doctor. We'd have our corridors full of patients on trolleys. We've have ambulances queuing up, and it is really stressful. I recently started a job in mental health, and actually that was even more heartbreaking. We had, you know, patients, mentally unwell patients, actually many often children who were from our area being sent to Yorkshire because that was the nearest hospital that had a bed. And that's really hard for anyone, but particularly if you're working in the NHS and you see that, you know that that's not okay, that's not good care. And yet it does seem, up until recently actually, that what we were seeing in the NHS and the problems, it didn't seem that it was cutting through to the public.
Yeah, I mean, Jesus, that's awful. Like, from London to Yorkshire for a mental health case.
Working in mental health, and I only did it actually for a couple of weeks, then I got moved because of this coronavirus, because of the outbreak. But actually that insight into how bad things are in mental health was really, really shocking. I think we do focus a lot on what's happening in our A&Es and our, you know, physical health hospitals, but actually it shockingly bad situation in some of our mental health hospitals with regards to not having enough beds and, you know, people getting put, you know, hundreds of miles away from their home because that's the nearest bed available. It was, you know, utterly outrageous. And I think if it was a physical health problem, you know, we wouldn't stand for it. But yet, for some reason, with mental health, they've managed, you know, year after year after year, the situation and our mental health services has been getting worse. And we've just had, you know, warm words but no action from the government about it.
And how do you feel about that kind of outpouring of love for the NHS? Not just the clap the other night, but also the adverts, the very kind of, the very, I don't want to say performative, but it is quite a kind of performative gratitude on behalf of the average citizen and the political class. Do you feel like that will translate into a kind of concrete difference afterwards, or is it bugging you?
I'm not sure if it will translate to a concrete difference. I think sometimes we do have selective amnesia generally as a British public. I think, you know, the clapping, it was great and it was lovely, but also it doesn't actually solve any of the underlying problems. And I guess also what I've been finding slightly uncomfortable, this talk about, you know, NHS heroes and all this, you know, love for the NHS, but actually you know, in the past couple of weeks and in the next few weeks, it is not just, you know, doctors and nurses that are keeping this country running, but actually it's our delivery drivers, it's our carers who are working in social care, it's our men on the motorbikes who pick up our samples and take them to the lab, all these people. And actually these people, the so-called low-skilled people who have been undermined for so many years by this government, they are the ones who are keeping this country safe and going over the next few weeks. Many of them don't have the financial security that they deserve, and they don't, I think, either have the respect from the government that they deserve.
I mean, I really agree with that. I think the whole narrative around low-skilled workers will be completely capsized by this event because, you know, it, apart from anything else, it's been proven so categorically how key they are to the functioning of society, how much more important than they are than Dominic Cummings, for example. But I suppose my worry is that there's already this kind of building narrative. People are trying to tack on a strivers and shirkers narrative, even to the coronavirus. So you have, you know, the people who aren't taking it seriously, people who are behaving irresponsibly, and they're kind of cast as these demon figures, the members of the British public who don't care about other people. And it seems like there's a kind of very deliberated attempt to make those distinctions afresh, having collapsed them in terms of, you know, what counts as low skilled and what counts as low value. Do you think that that's wrong? Do you think actually we're in quite a good place in terms of national unity?
I know, I actually completely agree with what you said. And I was really disturbed when I saw this, I think it was this weekend, we had this COVID idiots trending on Twitter. And it was, you know, people shaming certain members of the public for doing certain things. And actually, I just thought, this is so ridiculous. You know, we've had such mis messages on what we should and shouldn't be doing from the government, whose responsibility it is to keep us safe. And actually, we're in the state that we are because of this government's delayed and lack of preparedness to deal with this crisis. So, you know, I have been quite, it is a bit concerning that we're so quickly on turning on each other to blame, when actually the blame lies solely on this government for allowing this virus to spread in the way that it has. It's a government's responsibility that our NHS is not in the best position that it can to deal with this crisis. And it's also the government's responsibility that they've not had, you know, the messaging from this government about social isolation, about distancing, about what to do has been so mixed. You know, we've had Boris Johnson standing on stage telling us to keep 2 meters distance as he stands within, you know, within 1 meter of his colleague. So it's just been ridiculous. So we think we need to really, as a public, I mean, as a movement, make sure that we understand that the problems have been caused by the government, not by individuals. It is the responsibility of the government here to keep us all safe and to put in the measures that are needed for us to do that.
I do think in this situation that, you know, going forward, the state is going to be much bigger in the future, but that's not necessarily optimistic for the left. I mean, what I mean by that is that it's really easy for the kind of nationalism that we're seeing globally to weld itself to a politics of a bigger state. So at the last general election here in the UK, where we obviously have our own nationalists and they're in government, I would argue, you know, 41% of Conservative voters put the NHS in their top three priority issues in that general election. So this is a big change in Toryism that we've seen. And I think going forward, the debate won't be around necessarily investment versus austerity, but it will be much more around, well, yeah, we're in favour of investment, but we're investment for our people.
But I think that, you know, it's going to depend how we play it. I mean, this is going to be, the outcome of this is going to depend on the social forces on each side, if you want. And, you know, I do think there are going to be people, and we're already starting to see it, who are beginning to talk about the cost of all of this and the necessity for austerity when it's over. You know, there was something in The Economist talking about this, and I've seen various commentators talking about it. So, you know, you treat it in a way like the financial crash in 2008, where huge amounts of money were released into the markets, released to bail out businesses and so on. And that was all very good for them. And who paid for it? The rest of us, in terms of austerity that's actually created some of the crises that we're now facing. So I think all these arguments are to be had, but, you know, it's like everything. Nothing's naturally going to come out of this unless we fight for it. And I'm absolutely sure that these were exactly the same battles that people were having after the Second World War, where, you know, my grandparents' generation turned around and said, well, if you can do this kind of stuff in a war, if you can intervene in this way in the economy, if you can plan, if you can take stuff out of the market mechanism, why can't you do it in peacetime? And of course, that's what provided us with the NHS and with so much of our welfare system. But I'm not sure it was inevitable. I think it was to do with the kind of politics that grew up and the resistance to what others would have done at the end of the war. And I think that's probably going to be the same situation that we're in now.
I'm sure that's right. But, it's a strange situation, isn't it, to compare it to the Second World War? And that's a very true analogy in lots of ways. But, of course, the Second World War was this huge mobilisation of the whole of society. And in this crisis moment, it's like demobilisation. Stop doing things. Don't go to your job. Just stay in home. You know, it's a very surreal moment for our society. No real comparison, I think, historically to the situation that we're in now.
Nick, I know you were really critical of the British government in particular as compared to the Italians, the French, the Germans. Do you think their response has caught up at all, or do you still think we're in the grip of this kind of lethal exceptionalism?
I mean, to some degree, it's caught up. Of course, they've absolutely been forced into the social distancing measures and the lockdown and so on, because people just were looking at what was happening elsewhere with horror. And I think that when those figures came out from Imperial University and the government was actually forced to confront the number of deaths that it was courting, it just saw that it is politically completely unfeasible. So it has caught up a bit. I think it could be doing way, way more. I mean, we put a lot of emphasis on social distancing as campaigners and saying we need to have more isolation. But actually, you know, the whole question of testing, I think has kind of fell off the agenda a bit while we were calling for that. And as far as I can see, it's still absolutely nowhere. I mean, if the people who are absolutely most at risk, who are treating the patients with coronavirus, still can't get properly tested, you know, that's just absolutely outrageous. And the protective equipment and all that kind of stuff for frontline workers, I mean, they're a long, long way behind here. But we started off a long way behind, and this is also the fault, not necessarily of the current government, but of the political party that's been in power for 10 years. I was looking at some of the statistics the other day about how many doctors we've got, and we're way behind the industrial country's average. I mean, we've got 28 doctors per 10,000 people here. Germany and Norway are up in the 40s, you know, 43, 44 doctors per 10,000 people, and the industrial country's average is about 33, 34. So, you know, we started this crisis from a low point precisely because we've had governments in power for however long who believe the market has a solution to all of this kind of stuff.
There is this sense that among doctors I've heard in the media and personally that people still aren't taking it seriously, and if they could see what doctors could see, they would take it much more seriously. Is that something you think, or do you think people actually are taking it pretty seriously?
I think the public are taking it seriously. As I said before, I think the messaging was on what to do and what not to do was confusing from the government. But I also think it's very easy from a privileged position to snarl when you see someone walking on the street or taking public transport. But actually, there are many people in really difficult situations who have to continue working, who have to go and visit a relative that's vulnerable. So I think it's very easy to be snobby about it when you don't actually realise what's going on in individual people's lives. I can tell you, because I had a conversation just before I went on isolation with some of my patients from the community, and I spoke to one of them, a gentleman that's severely immunocompromised, and he understands that he's really high risk, that he needs to be shielded, but he told me that, you know, in his house, his brother is still having to go in and out of the house every day to go and open up their shop, and I explained that that's really risky because he could bring the infection into the house, but he said, look, I have to do this, I have two daughters, one of his daughters is disabled, they needed the money to come in to provide for his family. So I think, you know, people don't understand that people are in very difficult positions, a situation where we have migrants who are living in our streets who don't have access to public funds. So the amount of money that they get per week, it's something about £40 a week, that's it. Tell me someone that can survive on that. Of course, they're going to have to continue working so that they can feed themselves and not end up on the streets. So actually, there are people in very difficult, very vulnerable positions who may not be able to sit at home and may need to keep going out and keep working, putting their lives at risk because they've not been given any other option. And again, the responsibility for that lies with the government.
There was the extraordinary, to my mind, policy example of that the UK government has put forward at the moment of ending homelessness in the UK in response to coronavirus.
They've said there'll be accommodation offered. They're just waiting on Westminster Council to book hotels. I'm definitely happy. I know I've got somewhere to go to now.
The most incredible admission that homelessness in our cities was not something that we needed to accept in the first place.
And I think this virus has actually shown that in a lot of cases, things that we knew to be true, but for example, like that, homelessness is something that if the government had the intention, they could sort out. Again, they have underfunding of our health, of our services, austerity was a political decision. And also welfare, you know, for years, I've seen this again in the healthcare service, how difficult it is for people to access the welfare that they need. In the clinic that I was working in, we actually had to hire welfare advisors to help people get access to the welfare, to get people access to the benefits that they needed. And then the government have, you know, very quickly made it much more easier for people. So that it was a political decision to make it so difficult for people to access welfare. So all these things that we know to be true have really been exposed, I think, in the past couple of weeks.
Just to speak quickly to your other activist interests, the rights of migrants and reproductive rights, it seems that there's a very different picture in both of those areas. With migrants, there does seem to be some acknowledgement that some of the petty-mindedness around right to remain and these really punitive application methods have to be suspended. And I wonder whether you think that will have a kind of long-term positive benefit. But then on the reproductive rights side, you know, It sounds like, I don't know whether I'm being over dramatic, but it sounds like a lot of women aren't going to be able to access an abortion over this crisis and they're going to end up without any choices. Is that right?
Yeah. And it has been utter ridiculousness on behalf of the government over the past couple of weeks. So our abortion policy in this country is generally ridiculous. So it says that for a woman to have an abortion, she needs to have two doctors sign to say that she can have abortion, and the abortion has to happen on a licensed premises. So of course, both those things, the abortion happening on the licensed premises and also two doctors signing for it, is something that's going to be, you know, impossible to do over the next few weeks with the lockdown and when we're trying to reduce social contact and with the staff going off sick because they need to isolate. So what we called government for them to change this. So we called for telemedicine to come in to allow consultations to happen over, you know, not face to face, but instead online. And then we've also called for an end for this two doctors to sign and actually saying, why can't midwives and nurses and other healthcare professionals do that? So then the government initially, the Department of Health said that they supported telemedicine, and then they withdrew the support and said that they didn't support it. And now they've done a U-turn on their U-turn and saying that they are again supporting telemedicine, which is great, but they're still refusing to support the fact that having two doctors is really unnecessary and means that we're not going to be able to provide all the abortions that are needed over the next couple of months. So it is just, you know, it's ridiculous, and we shouldn't have to spend so much time trying to campaign for this, because it is pretty basic that women should be allowed to have abortion over the next couple of months. And having these sort of ridiculous, unnecessary legislation there is going to create another crisis. But yeah, I think it's a campaign that we're still working on. So I guess your listeners, please join and help us out on that.
Well, I think for me, the issue that's really interesting about all of this, and one of the things in a way that gives me hope, and it comes to the migrant point, is that, of course, some of us can insulate ourselves to some degree from this virus. You know, I'm in a very lucky position where I can work from home and don't have to go out very much and can afford to get my food delivered if I can ever find a slot. But actually, we are dependent upon more vulnerable people in society, and we cannot insulate ourselves completely from this virus spreading, precisely because some people in our society completely lack rights and are treated like shit, basically. And this has been going on a very long time. And there's been an idea in our society that the rich and the middle class can kind of live in gated communities and separate themselves from the kind of poverty and suffering that exists in the world. And they can't. I mean, that's what this is showing, that to a very real extent, we are only as safe and protected as the most vulnerable people in our society and the most vulnerable people in the world. And that obviously applies to the homeless in this country. It applies to people without rights in the workplace. It applies to migrants. And I think we're going to find out, unfortunately, very soon, it also applies to people impoverished in their millions and millions in the global south, because you can contain this potentially in one country with a lot of resources. But if this virus continues to spread throughout Africa, Asia, poorer countries in Latin America and so on, ultimately we'll end up back here again and we'll end up in the same situation. So, you know, the thing that I really hope comes out of this for people, the wake-up call for people, is that we can't continue living the kind of nice life that some of us have if we absolutely ignore, you know, vast parts of our society, vast parts of the world. And that's the thing that gives me some hope that this might begin to change attitudes around homelessness, migration, global poverty, and that kind of thing.
How hopeful are we about the situation? So it feels like it's been going on for ages, but we're obviously only at the beginning. Is there any ray of hope in terms of what's happened in the Asia Pacific? South Korea, China seem to have ameliorated the effects of the virus through mass testing, etc. Is that a hope that we could have some kind of return to normality sooner?
So I think what South Korea and China have shown us is that measures such as extensive testing, contact tracing, and quarantining affected people can slow down the spread of the virus and get on top. So yes, there is hope. I do think we need to put more mass testing and more community testing so that we can do this. The virus is not going to be with us forever. We will get on top of it.
And like Sonia says, look, we're going to get on top of this virus eventually, and hopefully a vaccine will be found, and hopefully we will be able to contain the virus before a vaccine is found. But I see the hope a little bit differently. You know, I don't think we should be hoping that we can just return to the way that everything was before this virus happened, because for me, this virus is sadly a wake-up call about the kind of world we live in, the kind of global economy and the vulnerabilities in that economy. The fact that, you know, even if it wasn't this virus, it would be a different virus that would have affected us because of the intense pressure we're putting on the food system and land around the world. And if it wasn't a virus or a pandemic, it was going to be climate change, which continues to be the major risk for life on this planet in the long term. And so for me, the hope is that we can take this awful situation and shake the world economy up in a radical way before it's too late. That we can actually stop thinking that everything's going to be just fine and life is going to continue just as, you know, for someone my age, just as I've known it my whole life. It isn't. That the world has become more unsustainable, more unequal, and we need to do something about that. And that needs to be really, really radical. And some of the policy measures that are going to need to be introduced, that have already been introduced and are going to increasingly be introduced in the coming weeks, you know, the really serious intervention in the economy, control and planning in the economy, these things are absolutely necessary to deal with the existential crises that we face as human beings at the moment. And so my hope is, far from going back to business as usual, that we can really put stuff in place to learn from this crisis, because we're going to need it.
That concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. Coronavirus Lockdown is a new series of podcasts from the Another Europe team, with support from Global Justice Now. If you want to know how the discussion ends, you can access additional material by joining the Another Europe is Possible campaign. Members of Another Europe help keep the show on the road, even in these difficult times. To join, go to anothereurope.org/join. In this week's Extra Time, we ask our guests how social movements can be built in the COVID-19 era of self-isolation. We'll be back very soon. See you then. And, of course, look after each other. Obviously, you're both campaigners. How on earth do we build a movement when you can't even leave your house? It sounds like with the reproductive rights stuff, you're in a situation where you've been forced to be really active, Sonia, because the government has adopted such a shitty position. So how have you been organising that campaigning intervention?
Yeah, so we're organising just like we're doing right now through online mediums. So having Zoom calls, Skype calls, talking on your phones, picking up the phone. And actually, I think there is a real... Obviously, you know, not having face-to-face contact, not having public meetings is tricky. But also, I think, actually, there is opportunities here. So I think the way I see it is that actually to go to a campaigning meeting, to go to a Labour Party meeting or go to a I Hate Brexit meeting, you're someone that's generally politically engaged and wants to take part. But if you're just a normal person, just scrolling across your social media, you may then come across, let's say, a video that people put out or a Facebook Live event. And actually, there's a real opportunity here for us to get people involved in our movement who may not necessarily have thought that this is something that they're interested in. So I think we can really open up many of our campaigns and broaden out our movements by putting more of our campaigns online. And there are so many different things you can do, like from videos, you can do public meetings online as well. And yeah, I think a real key to it is making sure that you're doing it through a medium that allows people to get involved and participate, and rather than just sort of one person talking and everyone listening, because I think you build movement by people feeling empowered to take part and get involved.
Okay, that sounds great. Nick, I want to know whether you're doing anything different to that, but also I want to know what you think of the opposition.
It's also preparation for climate change, isn't it? This whole situation, in not just in terms of the epochal significance, but people realising, well, actually, I don't need to take a flight necessarily to talk to people in Budapest and Vienna, that it opens up this whole new range of opportunities to organise in very effective ways without necessarily having the same kind of climate hitting effect.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, I don't think air travel's ever going to go back to the way that it was before. And of course, that's really a positive thing. I mean, we couldn't continue flying like that. And hopefully people will have got used to communicating with each other in different ways. And we have, I mean, you know, we're lucky in a way that this has happened when we have all this amazing communications technology and it's possible for us to do all of this. On Saturday, it was supposed to be our 50th anniversary as an organization. And we had a big conference planned in London, and we couldn't do it in the end, but we did an emergency kind of webinar on the situation and the global justice aspects of it. People absolutely loved it. I mean, it was great to have so many people in the virtual room. And the one thing we found that is actually an improvement when you're trying to get people to hear different voices from countries around the world, from the global south, obviously that you know, if you're doing that physically, it has an impact on the environment and so on. What we're finding now is we can get all sorts of people to talk to us who it would have taken months of preparation and money to bring over and so on. We can have several of them in one meeting. I mean, we're really, you know, you might you could be next door or around the world, and you're kind of in the same position now. So there's something a little bit kind of more equal and quite liberating about that. And we've got a whole series of kind of virtual meetings that we're trying out with our local activists and so on. So I think it's really good to be challenged sometimes as a campaigner, because you fall back on doing things the way that you know how to do things. That's easiest, and that's what you replicate. And to actually be in a situation where you're forced to think a bit more creatively about how you build pressure and so on. We haven't done anything like a kind of online protest yet. So, but we'll. I'm sure there will be definitely ways of applying pressure to politicians and decision makers and so on that we haven't tried before. And you know, that's probably good for us thinking, like you say, Luke, in the future when we're not able to travel around the world in the same way that we are used to doing over the last 30 years. You know, how do you continue to build solidarity? How do you continue to communicate with people living very different lives? How do you use that to mobilize and build a movement? And actually, yeah, the technology we've got today is absolutely fantastic for allowing us to do a lot of that stuff.
Labour Campaign for a Free Movement did an action protest on Sunday, actually a banner drop from your home. I mean, me and Nat didn't get quite as far as the balcony because it was blowing very intense wind outside, but we did do a photo call in the comfort of our own home and put it on the internet.
Right, but that's really interesting, right? Because Another Europe is well known for its famous banner drops, which is great, but most of those banners are dropped off Westminster Bridge, which means that, you know, people get to see it on social media and in the media if they're very attuned to the politics that are going on around them and they're very connected. But actually, if you start doing banner drops from your window, you're going to get loads of different people seeing your messages, like Sonia says, who aren't the same kind of plugged in activists that we're used to talking to. And who knows, we might actually go back to beginning to talk in our local community about big picture politics in a way that I think, you know, if you can just travel around, it's easy to stay in your bubble. It's easy to talk to people who agree with you already. Whereas actually, if you're dropping something from your window, you know, you're talking to your local community. You're talking to people who you're probably not used to being active with at all. And I think some really interesting new activist networks are going to arise from this that could be really powerful in the future.
Yeah. And actually, we forget that having meetings, which tend to be in London, can be very difficult for a lot of people to attend. So if you've got disabilities or if you've got caring responsibilities, actually, you often can be quite excluded from some of these meetings. So having them online, we may find as well that it allows more people to get involved and more people outside of London as well. So I think there could be some real positives coming out of this.
Fantastic.
Do we want to talk quickly about whether the opposition is responding in an effective way, or shall we leave that for a whole other podcast?
They seem to be doing all right, but the Tories are on 54% in the opinion polls. The Americans have an expression for it, don't they? Rallying to the flag. Like, I thought Trump was going to be finished by coronavirus, but his approval ratings have gone up, which is just a clear sign that I don't understand public opinion.
What's wrong with people?
But I think that will start to change. You know, I mean, at the moment, a lot of people in Republican heartlands haven't seen the effects of the virus. And there's a huge amount of people who still believe this is fake news. I mean, they believe what Trump was saying early on, because this is also being pumped out by various kind of right-wing media channels and so on. And I think it's only unfortunately going to be when people see the actual results on people that they know, the actual impacts of this, that people could potentially really start questioning him. But of course, you know, I mean, like we said earlier, this it can go in either direction, can't it? I mean, there's no question it can support authoritarians in power grabs, in imposing shock doctrines and so on. Or, you know, we can use it for different purposes.
Yeah. Okay. I think that on that happy note, we should thank you both for your insights, which have been depressing and hopeful in equal measure.
Yeah, absolutely. And good luck back at work tomorrow, Sonia.
Yeah, good luck, Sonia.
Healthcare hero. Thanks so much for taking the time out to talk to us.